This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The number of ways educators were able to do their jobs and serve their students during the COVID-19 pandemic is probably equal to the number of educators that exist. Just about every teacher has a personal story to tell. Today, we're going to Alexandria, Virginia, to meet Rabbi Bailey Romano. She was just about a year into her career as a Jewish educator when she had to take an entire religious school online. But some intimate experiences with disaster in her past uniquely prepared her for the challenges of COVID. Erin Phillips has the story.
Until I was 13, I used to walk around on the playground for part of my recess and pray to God. That was something that I did, which is probably why the kids thought I was pretty weird.
This is Bailey Romano. She's a rabbi who leads the religious school at Bethel Hebrew Congregation in Alexandria, Virginia. Her journey to become a Jewish educator has been unconventional, and her first year teaching did not go as planned. But her unique origins as a teacher and as a Jewish leader prepared her shockingly well for the challenges she'd meet in 2020. Her poise, passion, and persistence in the face of tragedy has become a lifeline for a community in turmoil. But before all that, Bailey, the kid who prayed on the playground, had to have a spiritual awakening. She wasn't born into Judaism. She discovered it on her own.
I never thought I would be a rabbi. I grew up going to Catholic school in Slidell, Louisiana, which is a little bit outside of New Orleans. And I always had questions. I always wanted to know why things were happening. And the nuns and the priests and the teachers that I had in Catholic school always said, because the church said so. That didn't quite work for me. But by the time I was in high school, I was really interested in Judaism. My aunt, my dad's sister, converted when I was growing up, and my cousin was being raised Jewish, and my grandparents' best friends were Jewish, and I grew up going to Seder and Hanukkah celebrations, and I always wanted to know when Passover was. I always wanted to know when Hanukkah was and wanted to learn more about Judaism. And so when I figured out the internet could be used for other things besides AOL Instant Messenger, I started researching Judaism and checked out all of these books and really fell in love with the idea of being Jewish and said, like, this is who I am. This is who I've always been. I just didn't know. I didn't have the words.
Bailey found her footing in the Jewish community, and now she feels right at home. When she started at Bethel last year, it was like magic. She clicked really quickly with the teaching staff and the community. She would spend extra hours at the synagogue just talking to parents and teachers and students. It was a perfect fit and a surprisingly smooth school year. It took 1 week for everything to change.
A number of congregations continued with our Purim carnival, and there were no restrictions. By Monday or Tuesday, when we did the Purim carnival for the preschool, there was some sense that things might be changing. Like, I was very hesitant to hug anyone or to do anything, and that doesn't mean that two-year-olds don't come up and hug you. This is how I got lice at the beginning of the pandemic. It was awful. I'll never forget, we had religious school Wednesday night, and everything was pretty much the same, but we had a student who had a little bit of a cough. And I was very scared. I was very concerned. And I had spoken with her father before, and she had sort of been fighting with a cold for a while before then, so we knew it wasn't COVID. I don't think a week before that we really realized that we would have to close the building or do anything differently. But by Wednesday night, after pretty much everyone had left, because I'm usually the last person who leaves the building, by like 8:30, Rabbi Sonat had called me and said, what are your thoughts about closing the school on Sunday? I said, well, what are other clergy doing? What's happening? And he said, you know, like, here's what's going on. And I said, okay.
Good evening, everyone.
I announced the teachers who were canceling religious school and instead doing our teacher training.
We are going to start by learning just a few of the basics.
Which I still don't exactly know how I pulled that all together in just a few days, but we were online in a week.
Shavuot Tov. If you have any questions, I'll be on for a little while.
From the Wednesday I made the call to the following Wednesday, we were online.
So please feel free to shoot me an email.
And post in the again, like everybody jumped when I said jump. And we're still jumping. I'm still figuring it out.
A week is not a lot of time to move an entire religious school online. First, you have to train the teachers and new technology, then the students. You have to break the news to parents that their kids will be at home on Sunday mornings. And a lot of parents freaked out that their kids would fall behind, especially when it came to Hebrew. When students fall behind in Hebrew, they risk not being ready for their bar or bat mitzvahs, which is kind of a big deal to Jewish parents. Bailey totally understood their fear, but she also knew she had to prioritize keeping religious school fun and safe.
We went from an enrollment that was about 210 to 180, but in comparison to many other congregations, we didn't lose as many families. A big part of it, I think, was that coming to Sunday school online gave their kids, especially at the very beginning of the pandemic, normalcy when public schools weren't in session, right? It took FCPS, Fairfax County Public Schools, 5 weeks to get kids online. So there was 5 weeks of parents not knowing if their kids were going to be back in school in any way, shape, or form, even if it was online. And so we proved very early on, by getting our kids online within a week of everything shutting down, that this was a place where kids could come, be themselves, have contact with an adult who was safe, with teenagers who were examples to them, and have social engagement that wasn't just learning, right? Once they got online for public schools, they weren't engaging in any social way per se, but the creation of social emotional learning and just games and fun online provided that consistency for our kids. And also just knowing that there were other parents and other kids and other families who were going through the same thing and connecting to something that is bigger than yourself.
Bailey spent a lot of time reassuring parents and teachers, but she was also simultaneously learning an entirely new routine, one with perks and challenges.
On any given Sunday, right, I might have been pulled in to be like, Timmy, you cannot hit Samantha. Nobody can hit anyone on Zoom. So I don't have to deal with any of those things, but they're just vastly different types of scenarios.
That was weird. Not sure what just happened. Hope you are able to get back on and that I'm actually on the Beth L live page.
There's less that can go wrong in some ways when you're in person than online because you're managing your tech.
There we go. My apologies. I have no idea what just happened.
And then all the kids are managing their tech. And if their tech goes, then you're also trying to navigate. That. So if a kid's audio isn't working or their video is off, because it can distract the other kids. And so then it changes the whole dynamic. And suddenly you're trying to help Sammy navigate their tech situation and not being able to manage the class.
I've never been kicked off of live like that. All right. All right.
Some of our kids aren't like super aware that they're on the camera. And so one of them showed up at one point with a shirt on. This is a male student. And then he showed up in class without a shirt on. And we all had to tell him, turn your video off, put your shirt back on. Which is not something in person you would ever, ever have to do. That happened twice in a year and a half. Different people, but not something I thought I would be experiencing as an educator.
Bailey couldn't have predicted shirtless students, but she did have an uncanny idea of what the darker parts of COVID would be like for the school and clergy. For Bailey, the pandemic has paralleled another upending she experienced as a teenager, one that helped shape her journey to become a rabbi.
I was 15 when Hurricane Katrina hit. I ended up in an odd situation where my parents are divorced, and typically I end up with my mom and my stepfather to evacuate. And I was in a production of Beauty and the Beast that weekend, and my grandparents and my dad had come in town, and so I evacuated with them. We were in Vicksburg, Mississippi. We got like one of the last hotel rooms there, and the power was off for about 4 days, and I was able to text my mother, but this is 2005, so my mother had no idea how to text me back. So she knew that I was okay, but I didn't know if my mother was dead or alive for about 4 days. My grandmother said New Orleans is gone, so we got in the car and drove to where she lives in Las Vegas. And I lived there for a month. And literally when September ended, as the song goes, I came home and came back to Slidell, and I came back to a whole new world. My mom picked me up at the airport, and when we drove home, right, I really could see the devastation that Katrina had wrought on homes and places that I had grown up with. The church that I grew up in had been completely destroyed, so it was a triangular-shaped roof, and it was totally opened up as if it was like a Chinese takeout box. And the organ, where I'd sang in the choir for many years, bent backwards. And the giant statue of Jesus had been totally shattered in the parking lot. And it really devastated the community in so many ways, including the priest. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. And I really had admired him quite a bit. And he was there when the storm hit and had to be evacuated by the National Guard, and he was never the same. He had to retire after that.
The images of the destruction Katrina wrought on religious communities and clergy, like Bailey's childhood priest, would continue to shape her work. She went on to study Jewish American history at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, then at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, Ohio.
That definitely led me into my research for yellow fever epidemics and their impact on rabbis and clergy in Jewish communities. Based on my research, I sort of knew that there would probably be an epidemic or a pandemic at some point, but I didn't think it would be in my time. And I never imagined.
What Bailey never imagined was that in 2020, she would use what she had learned to navigate roughly 200 students and their families through a global pandemic. It was a strange and haunting confluence for her. And knowing what she knew, she worried about long-term impacts others couldn't quite see yet.
Katrina took a really, really long time to rebuild from. Yes, there was the one moment of Hurricane Katrina destroying everything, but there were months and years of ongoing rebuilding in which trauma continued to exist. And the world that we're living in right now, we've lived in a state of fight or flight for a year and a half. And that's taken a huge toll on all of us psychologically, physically, emotionally. And you can see that very, very clearly in the way we interact with each other. And simultaneously, from my research and just awareness of spiritual communities after the storm, right? Spiritual communities were separated, right? There were Jews who lived in New Orleans forever and were suddenly in Baton Rouge, and their rabbis were going from wherever they were located in Houston or Austin or wherever back to these other places where diaspora communities of their congregants had been in a big way. That's what we've been doing online. Right, we've been finding each other and trying to create community in that way. And that loss of continued support system is also going to reverberate.
The thought of the trauma families would go through kept Bailey up at night. She made it her personal mission to find a safe way to keep person-to-person connection going strong at Bethel. Obviously, her colleagues, even her husband Ben, doubted that would be viable. But Bailey found a solution in a place she's often turned to grapple with disaster, Jewish American history.
The main idea actually came from historical research of pictures of kids in New York during the Spanish flu epidemic, of kids all bundled up on the roof of some building in New York with some overhang, learning. It was a school on top of a building. And I was thinking, well, if they did it then, why can't we do it now? My goal was to have a 20 by 40 tent where we could do programming. And I started coming up with, okay, where can we put kids outside? How do we do this? And was really, really dedicated to creating the scenario in which our kids could be in person in some way, because it was what I was hearing from our parents. Our parents were saying, you know, like, we really need this. This is the only way maybe we'll come to religious school. And I said, okay, all right, let's figure it out. And so it started with, we purchased 2 Easy Up tents, which were not easy to put up. Actually, it's a misnomer. And we're very blessed to have a huge parking lot and lots of outdoor space. And said, okay, let's use what we have and create something powerful. Like, even if our kids learn nothing, even if they do nothing, they'll be in person and they'll see each other. And bringing our parents in was another piece that was really important to me. As much as I would love to give our parents the Sunday morning off to just drop their kids off for an hour and leave, I also knew that they needed to see other parents who were struggling too, and to be there with them and to know that they're not alone. So somehow it happened. And I'll be very honest, the reason why the synagogue bought the much bigger tent was for bar and bat mitzvahs. But thank God, I mean, it made a huge difference for us as a religious school. We were able to run 3 locations simultaneously and bring half of the school to Bethel every other Sunday in the spring, which is dainu. Like, that's enough. Seeing that first group of kindergartners outside and their parents at these tables was just so powerful. Knowing that they hadn't seen other kids in months, that they hadn't seen their peers at Bethel in months, and the parents hadn't seen each other. And I just stood there far away and I just cried. And I just said, okay, all right, this is it, right? This is where we start the healing process, even if it's just a little bit, even if it's just for a moment. Like, this is the tikkun. This is the repairing after the breaking of our world with COVID.
Bailey's worked hard to facilitate that tikkun, that repairing. In addition to running the religious school, she organizes teacher trainings and social check-ins, special holiday events for families, a weekly prayer and meditation service, and has been running virtual Saturday morning Shabbat services for the entire congregation throughout the pandemic. But somehow, doing all of this brings her peace. Because that's how Bailey experiences her Judaism, her life's calling, as a way to find the beauty in the chaos. And she's finding it, for her community and for herself, one day at a time. Particularly Fridays, which took an unexpected pandemic turn for her and her husband.
The thing that I do remember personally was that suddenly Ben and I were at home for Shabbat, which never happens. Figuring out how to do Shabbat services online together, and then getting Shabbat together, which was a bizarre experience because we're both Jewish professionals, and so usually we're leading Shabbat services in very different locations, and that was very comforting, actually, to be able to. The whole world was crashing down around us, and yet we still had Shabbat and we had it together.
This segment was produced and voiced by independent reporter Aaron Phillips in Alexandria, Virginia. Still to come, a university chorus director kept an entire city singing during the pandemic. We'll hear them next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The choir director at the University of West Florida in Pensacola is now sharing his musical vision with the whole community, and he took that project on in mid-pandemic. If you were walking past the parking garage on the corner of Balin and Main Streets in downtown Pensacola one day this past March, you were treated to this. COVID-19 has not been kind to performing artists, but with a little innovation and out-of-the-box thinking, the Choral Society of Pensacola made the best of the situation.
We are one of the only community choruses that I'm aware of that continued rehearsing through the pandemic.
Dr. Peter Steenblick is director of choral activities at the University of West Florida and the newly appointed artistic director of the Choral Society of Pensacola. He says that the Choral Society not only rehearsed, but found interesting locations to connect with a live audience.
We had a creative season. The first concert was done in a gazebo on the PSC campus, and we had two performances. I believe audience was around 150 people. The next performance was in a parking garage downtown near the Levin Papantonio law firm. And we had well over 200 in attendance there, spread out throughout the parking garage on three levels of the parking garage.
Steenblick was named the interim artistic director of the Choral Society in September and was appointed permanent director in May. He is familiar with taking over an existing set of artists. In 2015, he came to UWF and started putting his mark on that chorus program.
One really valuable way to step into an established program is to look at the history and where the program has been and really familiarize yourself with that and be respectful of that. As I've been stepping in at UWF, we've been bringing back old traditions just as much as we have been creating new traditions.
One of the old traditions that Steenblick brought back was the UWF Summer Festival Chorus that was discontinued in the 80s. That program was open to all singers age 17 and older and was held in mid-July. Dates have already been set for next summer in June. As he gears up for a new school year, Dr. Steenblick is assembling the UWF chorus. He says that while talent is important, he looks for other skills in his chorus students.
Do they show up on time? Do they do what they're asked to do? Do they work hard outside of class to prepare? I often find that there are students that have a lot of talent, yet those professional skills are still developing, and that's the key. My personal view of choral singing is that at a university experience, that choral music is simply the vehicle to train responsible adult behavior. And I think that's true of a lot of entities on campus. And so what we really strive to do is create that professional environment. And then the music making is easy.
The music making has been anything but easy over the past 18 months. Going forward, Peter Steenblick says the Choral Society of Pensacola has plans for a modified season in various locations around the community. They'll be staying away from larger venues like the Sanger Theater and will be using chamber or modified orchestrations.
For example, our first concert will be at the Pensacola High School Auditorium. Which seats 1,100 people. Now, we don't expect that to be the audience size, but to spread 400 to 500 people around in an 1,100-seat capacity will help the audience feel a little at ease.
And while there are no plans to return to playing parking garages, Dr. Steenblick admits the acoustics in that structure made the performance that much better.
It was amazing. It was more acoustically sound than a cathedral built in Europe, you know. It was a wonderful environment for us.
And Dr. Steenblick has already begun auditioning new singers for both the upcoming season of the Choral Society and for the new school year. If traffic is getting backed up in your city, blame the left. And we're not talking politics. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Hate waiting to make a left turn at a busy intersection? You're not alone. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Vikash Gaya, associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Penn State University, delves into how to fix these time wasters.
Intersections are dangerous because they are where cars, often moving very fast and in different directions, must cross paths. When drivers make left turns, they must cross oncoming traffic, which makes intersections much more complicated. One way to accommodate left turns is to have vehicles wait until a gap appears in oncoming traffic. However, this can be dangerous as it relies entirely on the driver to make the left turn safely. Another way to allow left-hand turns is to stop oncoming traffic and give cars turning left their own green arrow. This is safer, but it shuts down the entire intersection to let left-turning vehicles go, which slows traffic. Instead, a simpler solution might be best. Restrict left-hand turns in busy cities. This would be safer and allow the intersection to serve more cars. There is a downside. Eliminating left turns would require some vehicles to travel longer distances. However, eliminating left turns on grid-like street networks would, on average, require people to drive only one additional block. This would be more than offset by the smoother traffic flow. Getting rid of left turns may be difficult to implement across an entire city, but they might not need to be. Left turn restrictions are most effective at busier intersections in the centers of towns or cities than at less busy intersections farther away from the town center. This is because the busier the intersection, the more people will benefit from smoother traffic flow. These central intersections also tend to have alternative routes available that minimize any additional distance traveled due to the restrictions. So, the next time you are sitting in traffic stuck behind someone waiting to make a left turn, know that your frustration is justified. There is a better way. In this case, the answer is simple. Get rid of the left turn.
That was Vikash Gaya of Penn State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.